Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
The good news, Florida's overall prosperity is up, but the bad news is that wealth isn't being evenly distributed.
To me, the real problem is lack of collective dividends. There are other things that are more important to us.
Also this week, opponents explain why they're against Miami Beach's plans to boost the minimum wage.
It's incumbent upon each employer and each business to decide what wage the market will bear.
We'll also find out that for all their differences, the Republican and Democratic nominees for Florida governor have found common ground in at least one area, and we'll also discover that the last two secretaries of Florida's Department of Juvenile Justice are going to be working together again at one of the capital city's most powerful lobbying firms. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. There's always more than enough bad news to go around, so let's start off this week's Capitol Report with some good news. Florida's unemployment rate is staying the same. State officials announced this morning that August's unemployment rate was 3.7%. That's the same as it was in July, and a smidge to tenths of a percentage point lower than the national rate of 3.9%. The latest estimates say there are about 375,000 unemployed people in Florida. Now, that sounds like a lot, but compare that number to a total workforce count of more than 10.2 million. The bottom line is that Florida keeps adding jobs, more than 20,000 more jobs in the last month alone. On the annualized side, the state has added more than 220,000 total jobs since August of last year. In total added job numbers, that lags behind only California and Texas. So, looking at the national big picture, there's more good news for Florida. The state's overall growth rate for the past 12 months was 2.6%, which was ninth in the nation. Okaloosa and St. Johns counties had the lowest unemployment rate at 2.9%, in case you're interested. Hendry County had the highest unemployment rate at 8.3%, followed by Hardee County at 6.2%. So the Florida jobs front is looking good, but there are some other economic areas in which the state isn't looking so hot. The number of Floridians living in poverty has fallen since the Great Recession, but it's still higher than the national average. According to federal data, 14% of Floridians had incomes below the poverty line. The figure is closer to 13.2% nationally. Lynn Hatter takes a look at what it means to live below the state poverty line, or in some cases, right on the edge.
Every Tuesday, hundreds of people began lining up early on an empty lot in Tallahassee's South City. It's just a mile down the street from the gleaming state capitol buildings, but here, instead of the city's famed live oaks, the lot is mostly barren, with just sprigs of grass and weeds, and on rainy days, puddles of mud. The delivery truck pulls up, unloading pallets and boxes of food. Some days, a mobile health truck comes from one of the local community clinics. On the other side of town, in the city's increasingly crowded Kearney Center homeless shelter, is Angel. He didn't give his last name, but says he's a veteran and a Syracuse University graduate who has been in and out of the shelter three times because of problems finding housing he can afford.
Out there in the streets, there's a lot of things that are going on. You know, if you sleep in the bushes, you're going to have problems. So it's better that these people here that open their hand to help us to get on our feet. Oh, yeah, I appreciate that.
The average price of a two-bedroom rental in Tallahassee is about $1,000 a month.
Moral revival means that we need to wake up.
In May, Tampa area Taco Bell employee Lillian Hall was drawn to the capital city to rally for raising the minimum wage as part of the Poor People's Campaign.
I am a single parent of four children, and it's very hard for me to live off my wages at Taco Bell. I've been there 2 years and I'm still at $8.74. I have to decipher, do I feed my children? Do I feed myself? Do I pay my bills? And it's not enough.
The dictionary defines poverty as the state of being extremely poor. The federal government defines poverty as earning less than $25,000 a year for a family of four.
Rates of hunger and poverty declined more significantly in Florida than in the nation as a whole over the last year. So that's the good news. The bad news is that those rates of hunger and poverty are still higher in Florida than for the nation as a whole.
David Beckman heads the Christian-based advocacy group Bread for the World. Federal data shows single moms and African Americans are more likely to live in poverty. 20% of the state's children, about 840,000 of them, are impoverished. And nearly 12% of households don't have enough to eat. Healthcare, housing, and childcare costs are factors, as are stagnant wages in a state where the minimum wage is $8.25 an hour. But Beckman believes the greatest contributor to poverty is apathy.
To me, the real problem is lack of collective dividend. There are other things that are more important to us.
Beckman says raising the minimum wage could help, and there are other solutions that don't cost money, like increasing tax credits for low-income people, along with immigration and criminal justice reform.
That would help us reduce the, in a responsible way, to have fewer people in prison, and then also better programs so that when they come out of prison, programs and policies so that when people come out of prison, they can get back into the job market.
Even as 2.5 million Floridians still struggle, the problem is nowhere near what it was during the 1960s, when about a quarter of Americans lived in poverty. Great Society programs like Medicaid, Medicare, and welfare contributed to significant declines in the poverty rate, and for the most part, it has stayed down, dropping to 11% in 2000, spiking to nearly 16% during the Great Recession, and dropping again to where it sits today. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
We told you last week about a minimum wage case before the Florida Supreme Court. We heard from supporters of a 2016 Miami Beach ordinance. This week, Florida Public Radio's Gina Jordan has reaction from the other side.
The issue is whether a 2003 state law stopping local governments from setting their own minimum wage supersedes a voter-approved constitutional amendment. Miami Beach City Commissioners voted to phase in a higher minimum wage that would reach $13.31 an hour by 2021. That would be about $5 more an hour than the state's minimum wage. Then Miami Beach Mayor Philip Levine spoke with WLRN shortly after he proposed the wage increase.
In 2004, 70% of the people of Florida voted for a constitutional amendment that allowed municipalities to set their own minimum living wage. We believe that the constitutional amendment that the people voted for has precedence. And of course, if the state decides to sue us and they don't believe that people in Florida deserve a living wage and they want to litigate, then of course we are prepared to do so.
The state did sue, and it was joined by groups including the Florida Retail Federation and the Florida Chamber of Commerce. The question is whether the constitutional amendment does what Miami Beach leaders say it does. They think it gives them the power to raise their minimum wage. Two courts have said it doesn't. The first phase of the wage increase was scheduled to begin at the start of this year, but before that could happen, a lower court and an appeals court ruled against the city. I spoke with Samantha Padgett, general counsel for the Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association, another plaintiff in the lawsuit. She says the association believes the minimum wage should be established at the state level to provide consistency for businesses and economic development.
We also believe, more specifically for a business, that each business should be able to decide for itself what its market will bear and what the wage should be. Of course, everyone should be in compliance with a statewide minimum wage at a very minimum, but anything over and above that, it is for the business to decide.
Well, let's talk about that. What is the potential impact on businesses if Miami Beach gets the okay to raise the minimum wage?
I think there's the potential for Miami Beach, but also you have to look at what the potential is for Florida as a whole. I tend to shy away from the argument of the hair on fire, every business will close. Yes, I think that it is possible, especially for smaller businesses, that there's the potential for that impact. I think what we need to look at, though, is the potential for broader impact, that if you make it more expensive to hire people at those minimum wage positions, that you're potentially foreclosing employment opportunities for those that are just starting out. out, teenagers and those that are younger for whom this is their first job, and for those that are older, senior citizens who are supplementing their income with part-time jobs. For a company to pay that much more for its labor, they're going to want that much more. Labor is a very significant cost for them. And if you make it more expensive to hire, they might look for more efficient ways to operate. Is there a robot? Is there a grill? Is there something that can be automated? Is there a computer that can do the same thing more efficiently and less expensively?
And on the other hand, would it help restaurants and hotels to have potential customers that make more money?
I think there's that argument there. I think ultimately it's incumbent upon each employer and each business to decide what wage the market will bear and to choose to be competitive. That's part of market competition. You want to find the best employer. You want to find the best wage. And in markets where there is a lot of opportunity, you want them to be competitive with one another.
So for Miami Beach, this isn't just about wages. It's about home rule and that community setting its own rules. Where does the association stand on the issue of home rule?
I think you can't look at it just, are we for home rule or are we not? In many instances, we absolutely support home rule. Communities have the right to define for themselves how they look, how they operate, to define the character and the nature of that community. However, we're becoming an increasingly more global, more interconnected society and economy. You can't say this is only going to impact Miami Beach. It will have an impact in neighboring and surrounding municipalities and counties, and will also cause other municipalities to look at, well, should we raise our minimum wage?
I haven't read the legal challenge, but did you specifically say that, you know, we're saying the 2003 law supersedes the 2004 amendment?
I think what's interesting about the District Court of Appeal decision is that they said that both of those things can exist without conflict with one another. So you have the constitutional provision that says that you can go over and above what is stated, but you have a state statute, a very constitutional state statute, that says the legislature is exercising its authority to limit municipal power by saying you will only have one consistent statewide minimum wage. And what the District Court of Appeals said, there's nothing in conflict there.
What do you think that amendment meant then?
They wanted to set a floor that was higher, and it was higher than the federal minimum wage. And we want to make sure that it increases as inflation takes place. So it forces the state agency to look at a consumer price index annually and raise it as inflation raises and as the cost of living raises. So to me, it says establishing that floor and making sure that, as indicated by the consumer price index, that it continues to increase incrementally.
Interesting. We'll see what happens. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity to share with you.
That was Florida Public Radio's Gina Jordan speaking with Samantha Padgett, General Counsel for the Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association. Still to come on Capitol Report, the two main guys running for Florida governor disagree on almost everything, except the need for more vocational-type training.
You were measured as being successful by what degree was hanging on your wall. Well, we've kind of had a paradigm shift.
We'll take a look back at the former head of the Florida Department of Juvenile Justice and her journey forward.
You know, children's issues and advocating for children's issues is something that is very near and dear to my heart, and is something that even if I wanted to get it out of my system, I don't think it would be possible.
And although Hurricane Florence missed Florida, a future cousin of hers could draw a bead on the Sunshine State, and Floridians had best be ready.
As we are now moving in the most active part of the hurricane, Atlantic hurricane season, the surveys are telling us we've got a lot of work to do.
Gubernatorial candidates from both parties this week debuted their education platforms to Florida voters. Republican Ron DeSantis and Democrat Andrew Gillum stand ideologically opposed on many fronts, like school choice and how to fund a teacher pay increase. But as Ryan Daly reports, one educational issue is getting bipartisan support: workforce training.
DeSantis and Gillum continue to be polar opposites at nearly every turn, but there is one thing they both seem to really like the sound of. Here's what DeSantis had to say during a Republican primary debate in Miami.
A four-year Brick and Ivy University is one way that people can get advanced knowledge and skills, but it's certainly not the only way. And if you look, we have a large number of students across the country, including in Florida, who end up with a four-year degree and then end up in a job they could have had at a high school. So I want to focus on concrete skills, skilled trades, but also science and technology and computers, because I think they'll be able to get skills and be immediately employable without having to go deep in debt.
And Gillum, at an Orlando rally with his new lieutenant governor pick Chris King weeks ago, struck a similar tone.
We're also going to reinfuse back into our public education system of this state the kind of thing that used to exist. Because while college worked for me, for my older brothers, it was woodwork, shop, mechanical, electrical, technical, all of those kinds of programs. All of those kinds of programs that if you were not on a college-bound track, and it's okay not to be on a college-bound track, it's okay.
So what is it about vocational schools that's made them an increasingly prioritized part of Florida's education conversation? Shelley Bell heads Leon County School's Lively Technical Center. She also oversees career technical and adult education for the district and says the vocational focus is both a paradigm shift and something of a rebranding.
The vocational education of 25 years ago is kind of pushed aside, and we have ushered in this, you know, broader term with career and technical education that really encompasses so much more.
Career training and education. The updated term, according to Bell, is indicative of how the different course and certificate offerings have expanded.
We're not just looking at, you know, people that can use their hands in automotive and diesel techs and building trades, but you also look at everything from digital design to network analysts to a lot of the jobs in computers and technology.
Bell has taken note of the bipartisan push for more career and technical education.
The idea now is being pushed by both candidates for governor that what we need to focus on is a skilled workforce. And so when you say skilled, it goes, well, what does a skilled workforce look like? It is students coming out of the K-12 system and going into post-secondary education and really capitalizing on completing programs where they are learning a skill that is marketable that they can get a job in.
And Bell says expanding career programs, like Gillum and DeSantis want, means giving them an increased role in K-12 schools.
If they don't know what those jobs look like in their backyard, and if we're not helping to expose those down in the K-12 system and create that pipeline, we're going to continue to struggle.
Though the two candidates likely won't be arguing on vocational programs, DeSantis and Gillum have agreed to several upcoming debates. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Daly.
The former head of Florida's juvenile justice system has a new job. After 4 years at the helm of DJJ, Christy Daly left her post at the end of last month. Sasha Cordner reports on the highs and lows during her tenure.
Since 2006, Christy Daly served the Florida Department of Juvenile Justice in different capacities. It included a stint as the Deputy DJJ Secretary under Wansley Walters. Then when Walters left in 2014, Daly took over the department's top job as Secretary.
We have made tremendous strides. We have 60% less low and moderate risk kids going to our commitment programs. We are at the lowest juvenile arrest rate in over 40 years in this state. We have the lowest recidivism for kids that are being treated on probation in the community. And I will tell you that the decrease of residential for those low and moderate risk kids, those kids are the ones in the community that are having better outcomes as a result now.
In addition to her job as DJJ Secretary, Daly also sat on several panels. They included the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School Public Safety Commission, which is tasked with looking into the failings of what led up to the mass school shooting in Parkland. There's also the Statewide Human Trafficking Council. Then there's the Florida Children and Youth Cabinet that was chaired by Daly's former boss, Wansley Walters.
From someone
who's walked a little bit in those shoes, I can tell you that she has just done an amazing job. She has increased the research and the data utilization in order to improve the outcomes.
During a recent meeting, Walters also commended Daly for working very well with the Florida Department of Children and Families to serve youth in both the juvenile justice and child welfare systems.
Unfortunately, there was a day and time in the past that DCF and DJJ didn't always work in tandem together. I can say those two agencies have come together and now just really exceeded everything that we could ever hope for the collaboration between both of those agencies with those children.
One particular thing both Daly and former DCF Secretary Mike Carroll have worked on is the human trafficking assessment tool. The goal, Daly says, is to help identify and track child victims of commercial sexual exploitation as well as labor trafficking. Criteria can include history of sexual abuse to running away.
It's allowing us to not only, you know, identify these young people, but it's also giving the state of Florida an opportunity to really look at what the needs of these kids are and how we can come together as a state to really address the service delivery and where the holes are in the state. It's certainly increased the collaborative effort between DCF and DJJ. And, you know, utilizing a uniform screening tool will allow us to not screen multiple kids multiple times.
Still, over the years, reports by the Office of Program Policy Analysis and Government Accountability has raised concerns about the tool. While it acknowledges improvements have been made, OPAGA's most recent report reiterates the need to have the tool validated to provide more accuracy in identifying more child victims. DJJ and DCF officials say they are dedicated to doing that, but don't feel they have enough data to move forward as yet. Meanwhile, under Daly's tenure, there were also concerns a few years ago over continual problems with a private contractor that operated juvenile justice facilities across Florida. Those issues range from sexual abuse allegations to multiple escapes. DJJ's contract for Youth Services International, or YSI, has since been terminated. And last year, Daly's agency came under fire during a Miami Herald investigation. It detailed physical and sexual abuse by detention officers and staffers, as well as horror stories of fight clubs featuring juveniles. Florida lawmakers held a couple of hearings for the 2018 legislative session, and she was forced to defend her agency.
I will not deny or discredit or downplay some of the horrible incidents that have happened. We respond appropriately to those. We hold people accountable. If we need to change policies and procedures, we do so. But it is not representative of this system.
A new law took effect in July that now allows surprise inspections into DJJ facilities. Its sponsor, Miami Democratic Representative David Richardson, says even before passing the legislation this session, Daly was pretty responsive in allowing himself and state lawmakers to tour the facilities.
Myself and a few members wanted to make a visit. I reached out to the secretary. I initially told her I wanted to go unannounced. She told me she would not oppose that. In fact, the next day she sent a letter advising everyone in the system, her DJJ system, that if a legislator showed up, they were to let us in.
Now Daly says she's looking forward to continuing doing what she loves, advocating on behalf of children.
I believe that this agency is extremely strong and will continue down that same path. And I will not be far. This, you know, children's issues and advocating for children's issues is something that is very near and dear to my heart and is something that even if I wanted to get it out of my system, I don't think it would be possible.
And in what may be a case of real deja vu, she'll now be teaming up with her former boss, Wansley Walters, at Ballard Partners, a prominent Tallahassee lobbying firm. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, Traditionally, this time of year is when we see the most and most severe hurricanes. The folks in the Carolinas just discovered that with Hurricane Florence. So far this year, knock on wood, Florida has not been the target of any major storm, but that could change at any time. The good news, as Regan McCarthy reports, is that the Sunshine State seems to be more ready to respond to such a thing now than it has been in years past, although that doesn't mean storm preparations can't be improved.
Yeah, it was a year ago that Hurricane Irma, as a Cat 4, made landfall in the Keys and caused damage all the way up the state. I live in Gainesville, and even as far north as we were, we lost power and had trees down for multiple days.
That's Craig Fugate, former director of FEMA, as well as emergency management in Florida.
You would have thought that since Irma caused so much damage and cost lives here in Florida and Puerto Rico and the Caribbean, more people would understand what's at stake. But again, as we are now moving in the most active part of the Atlantic hurricane season, the surveys are telling us we got a lot of work to do.
There are some things Floridians are doing well. For example, Fugate says good plans are in place for most of the state's pets.
When we say prepare for the family, I think we did a good job of getting the message out about pets, but I think we still got to remind folks that people need to be prepared and supplies need to be checked and ready.
According to the survey, having enough ice on hand and having cash in case ATMs or credit and debit cards stop working are areas where Floridians could be better prepared. Another area of concern is insurance. Guy McClurkin is the executive director of the FAIR Foundation. He says homeowners need to have a good understanding of what their insurance policies cover.
Our survey was pretty revealing. Unfortunately, more than half of the respondents in our survey, 57%, did not know the amount of their hurricane deductible. And a hurricane deductible is one of the largest short-term financial obligations following a disaster that any of us face. And out of that number, only 15% of Florida homeowners were aware that the actual hurricane deductible average is around $5,000 per event, per storm.
And officials point out most home insurance policies don't include flood insurance. Michael Braun is the CEO of FedNat Insurance Company. He says many Floridians don't carry flood insurance because they think they don't need it.
Even if you are not in a flood zone, you should think about purchasing flood insurance because water does not stop at a line on a map. Multiple storms in multiple states, including Katrina in Louisiana, Sandy in New York, and countless others in Florida, have caused significant flooding in recent years. Those homeowners with flood insurance had an opportunity to rebuild their lives, while those without flood insurance faced devastation that they may never fully recover from.
Officials say now is the time to take action. They urge homeowners to speak with agents to better understand their policies and decide whether they need more coverage. They're also encouraging families to make preparedness kits. They say waiting until a storm is heading your way is waiting too long. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Ryan Daly, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, and Regan McCarthy. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport. And please join us each week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: the Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.